since 2014. Her previous experience includes work in HIV pharmacoepidemiology, linkage and access to care for HIV-positive women, social and health-related rehabilitation of leprosy patients, and lab work with strep pneumoniae. She graduated with her master's in public health, maternal child health from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in 2014 with an interest in infectious disease epidemiology and public service. And she will be talking to us today about a large mumps outbreaks, that's plural, associated with four universities in Indiana in 2016.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you to everybody for being here today. I'm excited to get to share a little bit about our mumps outbreaks in 2016. And I will probably use outbreak and outbreaks a little bit interchangeably because there was community spillover that we didn't know what to do with in some cases. And since we had Nakia's excellent overview, I'm going to keep our background a little bit short and focus on some of our experiences and takeaways. So mumps is a viral illness characterized by parotid swelling and primarily spread by droplets through direct or indirect prolonged contact with an infectious individual. As we know, the U.S. has seen a higher than normal number of cases and outbreaks over the past years, many of which have been linked to outbreaks in universities and amongst college students. Currently, isolation is recommended for 5 days after parotid swelling onset, and 3 cases constitutes an outbreak of mumps, following which certain additional control measures are generally implemented, including things like exclusion of persons without adequate proof of immunity in the outbreak setting and mass vaccination campaigns. So in Indiana, 4 outbreaks of mumps were declared in 2016. The outbreaks primarily occurred in students of 4 universities, Butler University and IUPUI, both in Indianapolis, Indiana University in Bloomington, and Purdue University in West Lafayette. For ease of reference and with permission, all universities have been named in this presentation. Butler University is a small private school with a total student and staff population of around 6,000, and the remaining universities are large public institutions with enrollments around or above 30,000 students. Also, all universities have relatively high reported vaccination rates among students. Significant community spillover was also noted in these outbreaks, particularly in the counties housing each of the universities, and index case exposures could be identified. We're also going to blame Iowa on some of our outbreaks and Illinois, for that matter, and some exposures were identified over spring break trips outside of Indiana. No connections between the universities were identified until several weeks into the course of these outbreaks. So this is an overall timeline, including first notifications and start and end dates. Our first outbreak also started on a Friday afternoon. And we counted any community cases with direct links to the outbreak or with no other known exposures as a part of the overall kind of outbreak that was going on because we did have a large amount of community spillover. Unfortunately, we weren't able to sufficiently link community cases to each other in order to ever declare a community-wide outbreak in any affected county. I wanted to highlight here, too, that most of our outbreak activities were occurring simultaneously sometime between February and April, so it was a little bit hectic, a lot crazier than we were expecting it to be, though certainly I feel like I've vastly understated that now that Virgie just went. So the overall outbreak window was from January 20th, 2016 to September 10th, 2016, when the last outbreak was declared over. Each suspected case was investigated and classified based on the current CSTE case definition for mumps. Information was collected regarding clinical presentation, vaccination status, risk factors, and epidemiological linkages. Furthermore, our syndromic surveillance system, Essence, was also used for case finding, utilizing a query for mumps, peritonitis, jaw swelling, and other keywords which were tailored throughout the course of the outbreak. At the universities where it was appropriate, vaccination clinics were held as part of outbreak control measures. These were focused on providing first and catch-up doses primarily, but were not marketed specifically as third dose campaigns. However, we didn't turn away any students or staff that knew they had 2 doses as long as they were eligible for a third dose at the time of the clinic. Additionally, the ISDH, Indiana State Department of Health, and local health departments issued both internal and external communications regarding case finding, laboratory testing, control measures, and outbreak updates. As part of the laboratory investigation, a locally developed and validated reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction, or RT-PCR test, for the N gene was offered by the Indiana State Department of Health Laboratory. The epidemiology and laboratory teams collaborated to create a process for authorizing specimens being submitted to the ISDH labs, which included an epidemiological consultation, collection of a case report, guidance on specimen collection and submission, and follow-up regarding results. An algorithm to assist providers with this authorization process and selecting an appropriate test was also developed and disseminated. A subset of specimens from this outbreak were then batched and submitted to CDC for genotyping. This is the decision tree that I just mentioned that we sent to providers, local health departments, and other public health partners regarding mumps testing at the ISDH lab. I know it's probably a little hard to read. The primary focus was to ensure collection of buccal swabs within 5 days from parotid swelling onset and to ensure that patients met clinical or epidemiological criteria prior to using public resources for testing. So moving on to our results. This epidemiological curve shows mumps cases by week of parotid swelling onset. MMWR week 3 corresponds with the week ending January 23, 2016, when our first case was identified, and week 38 corresponds with the week ending September 24, 2016, a week after the outbreaks were declared over. Vaccination clinics are included on this curve, and notably, cases at Butler University dropped sharply after their very well-attended vaccination clinics, which I'll describe in a little bit more detail later. Some other events of note are also included, like the Little 500 and Grand Prix races at IU Bloomington and Purdue, respectively, as well as Purdue's graduation. These events typically include large gatherings of students and community members and involve many satellite parties and other close contact opportunities. Events were mentioned by cases and corresponded with spikes in outbreak cases approximately 2 weeks after those events, which is consistent with the average incubation period for mumps. So our key findings, we had a total of 293 cases identified during the outbreak period. 62% of these cases were in students or staff at outbreak universities, and 37% were in community members. Among community members, only 31% had an identified epi-link either to an outbreak at a university or to another community case. However, multiple bar socialization, sharing of smoking utensils, sharing of drinks was reported amongst both university and community cases, making identification of definite links difficult. Only one school was able to successfully implement recommended exclusions, and complications were relatively infrequent. We only had one report of meningitis, which required an overnight hospitalization, and 5 reports of orchitis or testicular swelling. 84.9% of university cases had 2 documented doses of MMR vaccine, and 6.7% of these actually had 3 or more documented doses prior to mumps infection. Over 5,200 doses of MMR were administered across 7 clinics. I should note here, though, that around 3,000 of those doses were administered during Butler University's vaccination clinics, which, if you remember back to the background, accounts for about half of their students and staff. Only 2 of the 4 universities collected immunization documentation that would be compliant with CDC recommendations for adequate proof of immunity. One collected partial information, so they collected month and year of the dose, and the other university did not collect information at all. During the outbreak window, ISDH sent out a total of 42 internal communications about the outbreaks and case finding, as well as 2 external communications to other states prior to times such as spring break, where students were likely returning to home states. Due to a 24-hour delay in syndromic surveillance data, no new confirmed cases were able to be identified by this method. However, 9 cases that had been reported by other means were caught by the system. The ISDH laboratory tested 504 specimens from 488 unique patients for confirmation by PCR, of which 42.7% were positive. ISDH disseminated the lab testing flowchart I showed earlier to providers at the end of March 2016, after which percent positivity of specimens submitted to ISDH increased, though it's not exactly clear how much of this is attributable to that guidance. Of 242 confirmed cases, 209, or about 86%, were tested at the ISDH laboratory. Of 19 cases who had a PCR or culture-positive test and also had information available for serum immunoglobulin M or IgM test, 11 cases were IgM negative and 8 cases were IgM positive. 140 of 142 specimens sent to CDC for genotyping were type G, and the remaining two were unable to be typed. So, in conclusion, Indiana experienced 4 outbreaks of mumps in 2016 in mostly vaccinated persons. The even spread of community cases, compounded by poor linkages available for some of those cases, indicated possible gaps in investigators' ability to elucidate links, or the possibility that mumps cases might be being underreported at baseline during non-outbreak periods in Indiana. Creating and disseminating a detailed testing protocol and requiring epidemiological consult for testing at the ISDH laboratory seemed to increase percent positivity of our specimens and also allowed ISDH to prioritize testing for clinically and epidemiologically important cases. Finally, laboratory testing in this outbreak supports concerns in the current literature about the reliability of commercial IgM testing in vaccinated persons. There are successes and challenges. We had some really great partnerships and communications with our university health centers and local health departments. Additionally, smooth clinic logistics and administration, robust laboratory testing at the ISDH lab, and robust laboratory testing also shown as particular successes during these outbreaks. However, some significant challenges were presented as well. Only one of the 4 universities was able to implement and enforce exclusions and provide for isolation of cases adequately. Getting administration buy-in to enforce exclusions was difficult, particularly when exclusion measures were dependent on vaccination status, and being fully vaccinated did not seem to be as protective as hoped for contacts. Additionally, inconsistent documentation of vaccination by universities created significant additional work to track this documentation down. Finally, personnel capacity across all partners also proved to be an issue, particularly with the lengthy duration of all of these outbreaks. One major takeaway from these outbreaks was that there is a need to standardize vaccination documentation amongst universities. And actually, 2 of the universities are the 2 that did not collect month, date, and year proof of immunity are both planning to move to a doctor-verified month, date, and year vaccination record starting in fall of 2017 for all of their matriculating students. Furthermore, vaccination as an outbreak control measure seemed to be effective in containing outbreaks early, particularly if provided to a large enough percentage of the affected population. And finally, identifying why these outbreaks are occurring and trying to tailor exclusion and control measures to better fit these reasons in this population could be useful in preventing outbreaks early as well. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge all of the many, many people who worked on this outbreak tirelessly for months, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mukta. Do we have any questions for Mukta?
Hi, Scott Lindquist, State Epi from Washington State. I work for Chaz. For you and the previous speaker, what is your recommendation on school exclusions? Should we be doing them? I know they create a lot of problems. We've got a lot of pushback in our state from certain counties, and staff is yet another issue. Would you, with what you know now, either speakers, would you do exclusions or not? I won't hold you to it. I just want your opinion.
Okay. So what we did for the universities that basically told us, no, we can't implement this or we can't enforce it, there's no way, what we did was we tried to at least evaluate close contacts and exclude close contacts that we knew would have come in, you know, would have been exposed to a particular person. And we ended up having to, even initially we were including classrooms and lecture halls and stuff as that group, and we ended up having to kind of pare that down too, because it was unmanageable from all sides. We didn't see very good patterns of transmit. So, well, it differed a lot between the different outbreaks. So, one of the outbreaks, we knew what the primary transmission setting was, and there was a pretty well defined link with cases in that transmission setting. For one of the larger ones, we didn't have a lot of epi-links at all between any of the cases until probably, you know, three generations in. And so in that situation, it got a lot harder because we weren't necessarily looking at just one, you know, set or any particular location. And one of the major pushbacks that we had was that students were generally, you know, 20 to 22, and so there was a lot of bar socialization reported, and, you know, even if you exclude in the school setting, that doesn't necessarily allow you to enforce exclusion outside of that particular setting. And so I think with the university campuses, it's a little bit more challenging than in a primary school setting to be able to enforce those exclusions appropriately. So to kind of give you the diplomatic answer, I mean, it depends on how much the university is willing to, and local health department is willing to do with that. We did, you know, the one university that did implement exclusions, you know, they looked up all of their exemptions, all of their one doses, and either told them, hey, you have to get another dose or you start the series or you have to leave campus. So, you know, and they provided a separate housing for isolation of all their cases. And with that kind of buy-in, I would say that it's probably a lot more effective, you know, or, I mean, speculating, but it's probably a lot more effective than if you don't have that kind of buy-in or that kind of enforcement.
But do you think exclusion affects your outbreak?
I think if implemented properly, it could, but we didn't see that it affected our outbreaks, but we weren't, the university that, it was Butler University was the one that was really on top of their exclusions, and around the same time that everything was happening, they also had these massive vaccination campaigns. So I think it was likely some combination of them being very proactive with excluding their, you know, their exemptions and have, you know, getting a very high percent of their population vaccinated. I don't feel like I have the best information to be able to say that it really was effective or wasn't effective in the other settings, because it wasn't very well implemented or enforced.
How about Arkansas? Do you think it made any difference?
Well, for us, this was in primary school, so, and most of our cases were in the 5 to 17-year-old age group. We did exclude students who were under vaccinated from school until the transmission within that school was over. And that could have been months that the child was out of school. But when we gave that option to the school nurses to give to the parents, a lot of them chose to vaccinate their children to avoid keeping their children out of school for that long period of time. But since, I don't know, it was a give and take, because 92% of those school-age children were up to date on the vaccines, and they still had the highest percentage of cases. So I don't know if excluding had an effect on our outbreak either.
Strictly speaking, we can't assess it because we excluded in every context. But we have seen exclusions work in the past for other diseases. We've seen it work in the past for mumps. Mumps in our situation was different in that we would exclude them to an extremely densely populated house which maybe even accelerated things in some environments, but they had nowhere else to go. The other thing with mumps is there's at least one out of five people can be infectious while not showing symptoms, so we wouldn't know to exclude those people. So, you know, we basically think that we exhausted the susceptibles in that Marshallese population, that our interventions, it's not clear that our interventions sped up the course of the outbreak or shortened it, anything at all. The other thing that I think the ACIP is going to review is, I hope, whether the exclusion period is an appropriate length. It used to be 9 days, and based on a few studies, it got shortened down to 5 days. And what we showed in our study is that we had, you know, 2 or 3% of people who shed longer than 5 days. And so it's not clear, at least among the Marshallese population that may be different, that that exclusionary strategy worked.
I would echo that.
You know, I please come on up. I think this is probably of great interest to the people in the room, and I'm hoping that then we may not take questions between the next two speakers.
Oh, is that all right?
Yes, it is.
I just thought I'd just, unfortunately, we, being from Iowa, we have a lot of experience. I did at one point get the title Mumps Queen, and I don't think I really want it, but I was just talking about exclusion. I just thought I'd say something. When we started, we did the 9 days, and we found that if we told a student to basically stay in their dorm room for 9 days, they would laugh and just do not do anything. So we went down to 5 days or until symptoms resolved, whichever was longer, and most were 5 days. But I will say, when we talked about 5 days, the university really had to do a lot of things in order to get that to be compliant. But in the end, it was compliant. But the things they had to do was, one, they had to find a place for the roommate to go, and they did that. But probably the ones that made the biggest difference was they said that the students, as long as they had a food ticket, could order any food they want and get it delivered to them. And they loved that. And then the second thing is they made it so that no professor could require them to do any work or take any tests or makeup or anything if they obeyed. And so then you're basically giving these kids a 5-day vacation in their dorm room, which they liked. And then they also were given masks because, of course, they would use the communal bathrooms and stuff. But they actually got very, very good compliance once they started doing those things. I wouldn't say it was 100%. And I do think that they did make a difference. When we started the outbreaks, we started seeing things like a beer party and a lot of spread coming out of that. And once we started having them stay in their dorm rooms or in their apartment buildings or wherever, that kind of thing did stop. But I do agree a large percent of people can spread it without having any symptoms. So. Who knows? But we also had very highly vaccinated. We were over 98% two-dose vaccinations because in our college you could not sign up for second semester classes without having two doses of MMR.
Hmm. Thank you.